Today's date is June 10th, 1998. This is a tape by Michael Wilker entitled Strawberry Fields Forever, under the general heading of Faith and Economic Life. The call number is WIM98-3. Let's listen in.
Valley, which is called the Paparo Valley, grow a tremendous amount of vegetables. And while Salinas was a larger town than Watsonville, we had about 15,000 people in Watsonville in the 50s and the 60s. Watsonville, for some reason, I'm not quite sure why, became the place where you got a lot of packers, where the fruit, where the vegetables would come in from the field and would come into packing sheds, and then would be either frozen or sometimes sent out then on trucks for next day eating. You know, we didn't have a whole infrastructure yet like we do today of being able to get fresh produce all the way to Chicago and New York. That was developing in the 50s and through the 70s. So frozen food became really important because that's the way to transport that. We had 20 different packing sheds that were all locally owned by people that had lived there a long time. Some of these old landowners, the Croatians and the Danes, built these packing sheds and the frozen food industry there. But after a while, the packing sheds start to buy each other out. And so by the 1980s, we have only two packing sheds left. So it went from 20 to 2. Not only were they once locally owned, and then they start consolidating themselves within Watsonville, but then also during this time, the United States food industry starts to get more and more centralized. And so the local packing sheds are getting bought out by first Pillsbury, which is based in Minneapolis, and then Pillsbury itself was bought out by Grand Met, which is a multinational corporation based in Britain, in London. So that's just one example of this jumping from a locally controlled packing shed to then something that's based in Minnesota to something that's based totally in a different country. So when those two packing sheds are left, oh, I gotta bring up the union efforts here. In those 20 packing sheds, they employed around 8,000 people, all members of the Teamsters Union. So they were 8,000 people were members of the Teamsters in a town of about 15 to 20,000 people. So that's, we were a union town. That was very, very important. As the packing sheds closed and consolidated, and as the Teamsters became corrupt, the numbers of members in the union dropped from 8,000 to just 2,000. So suddenly we have less union representation by the 1980s. The people who were working in the packing sheds also changed. Early on, they were the Croatians and the Danes and other whites. In the 70s, they started to become predominantly Mexican and predominantly Spanish-speaking. So the workers in the sheds were Spanish-speaking, but the union bosses were all English-speaking and did not communicate with their workers at all. They were union bosses making the decisions and making backroom deals with the packing shed owners. The workers themselves had no democracy in the Teamsters in Watsonville. They actually formed Teamsters for Democracy movement to try and reform the Teamsters Union. And part of that started in Watsonville with the Spanish-speaking workers. And eventually they got those union bosses unelected and took over the union. It was bad timing though, because by that time there's only two more packing sheds left, and one of them was going to transfer their shed to Mexico in the 80s already. And so the workers decided we're going to go on strike. So in 1987 they started a strike, which lasted and became the longest strike that up to that point in United States history, 2.5 years. And they were dealing, this was with Pillsbury and Grand Met. And the multinational corporation still decided to close down the packing shed in Watsonville and pull out. And so there was hundreds of workers that were unemployed then. the union was able to get some concessions for retraining to get to other jobs, which has had moderate success. That was in 87. In 1989, right here was the epicenter of the Loma Prieta earthquake. The earthquake that everybody knows about in San Francisco, but it was, the epicenter was right here. And so almost all of the housing in Watsonville was affected off its, off their foundations, and almost the whole downtown was destroyed. The big Catholic church had to be totally rebuilt. It was devastating to our community from an infrastructure perspective. But the folks say that that was one of the places where they started crossing the boundaries among all the races in Watsonville, because that disaster had to bring them together. They had to come together to help feed one another, to help rebuild their homes and stuff. But what it pointed out, though, too, was already the overcrowding of housing in Watsonville. There was, you'd have a house on the lot, and there would be maybe two or three families living in that house, paying $1,000 to $1,200 a month per rent. And then behind it would be a garage, and there would be maybe 10 single guys living in the garage. Mm-hmm. And behind that was a lean-to, where they would be living maybe about another five guys or something with a dirt floor. And all these folks would be paying rent to the same landlord. The folks in the garage and in the lean-to, totally illegal in that housing situation. But suddenly we realized that there were more people living in Watsonville than we had decent housing for. That's an ongoing problem there. Then, in 1995, there was a flood. The Pajaro River, which separates Watsonville from that little community called Pajaro, flooded. And the whole village of Pajaro, which now was a Mexican community, 90%, 98% Mexican, was totally flooded, as well as all of the fields on that side of the valley, almost all strawberry and lettuce fields. So it was devastating to their livelihood, because they weren't getting any money for picking strawberries because there was none to pick at that time, and also devastating to some of the growers and farmers. That leads us up to 2 years later than 1990, or just a year later, 1996, when the United Farm Workers wants to re-instigate its organizing efforts in the strawberry fields. Any questions about the history that I've given you so far? You say few, Esther.
So many events so close together, just disasters.
Yeah. Earthquake, wind, and fire. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even mention NAFTA, which NAFTA passed, you know, during the 1990s too. Mm-hmm. And that's like another earthquake that hit Watsonville. Then also in California, the anti-immigrant, especially anti-Mexican sentiments that are going on in California passed the anti-affirmative action laws and initiatives that try to take health care away from undocumented immigrants and schooling too. So a lot of pressures hitting Watsonville all at one time. Alongside of that, let me just give you an update on the United Farm Workers. They were started in 1966 by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and some other folks. They started off with only 200 members in the beginning. They worked hard, and by 1970, after the grape boycotts that you might remember, from 1970 to 73, they had 80,000 members across the United States, many of them in California. That was the highlight of their membership. That was, after those initial contracts expired, the farmers decided to give the contracts to the Teamsters Union, because the Teamsters and the UFW were at odds with one another. They were fighting back and forth, sometimes very violently, fighting back and forth. And so the original contracts went over to the Teamsters. And so the UFW membership dropped to about 5,000, from 80,000 to 5,000 in just a couple of years. The UFW kept on working hard, and they became aligned with the Democratic Party in California. And they helped in some ways get Jerry Brown elected. And so Jerry Brown, the governor of California at the time, helped get the Agriculture Labor Relations Act passed. And that guaranteed the right to access to the fields of union organizers. It's the only place in the country that union organizers can go into the fields and talk with workers themselves. In other places in the country, they have to stay outside of the property and wait until the workers get off the job to be able to talk to them or to go and talk to their homes. The Agricultural Labor Relations Act also gives unions the right to get a list of all the workers at a farm so that they can find out how many workers there are. It gives the unions a lot of power and ability to go in and do organizing. It also guaranteed some minimum levels of safe water and drinking conditions, bathrooms, porta potties being able to be brought into the fields so that the workers could have access to bathrooms right there in the fields. So it gave them a kind of a minimum, a base level of worker rights. It also made it easier, you know, like I said, to do organizing in the fields. So during the Democratic government in California, the union membership jumped up to about 40, 50,000 again. But then the Democrats lost the election in the 1980s to George Duke Majan. George Duke Majan cut money for enforcing those laws, so there were less people going out checking the fields to make sure that agricultural workers had access to these things that were guaranteed by law. And he also changed the composition of this board called the Agriculture Labor Relations Board, so that it was, some people's eyes, tilted back in favor of the agricultural industry. Under the Democratic regime, it was tilted towards labor. So it tilted back towards the growers. So then during the 1980s, the UFW membership dropped again down to 21,000. By 1993, it was at 21,000. And that's when Cesar Chavez died, was in 1993. Internally, the UFW went through a really hard transition to find out who would be the next leader, who would be the next president. Arturo Rodriguez came out as the new president, and after a few years kind of solidifying the infrastructure of the UFW, then said, okay, how are we going to re-energize the union movement? Under Cesar Chavez, in the last years of his life, the UFW had become very hard-nosed and would not negotiate with farmers. They made demands, and if you didn't accept their demands, then they would try and shut you down. Cesar Chavez once said, we will rule or we will ruin. And that's very threatening to the farmers, and they still remember that to this day, that the UFW will shut you down if you don't cooperate with them. So Arturo Rodriguez had a hard time working with the farmers because they didn't want anything to do with the UFW. But he is more of a negotiator, and he will give concessions to growers in order to get a contract. Because then once they get a contract, then they have members, then they can start working. And so he's trying to be a little bit more politically savvy in his negotiations and relationships with the growers. But they're still very wary of the union. Because of his new stance, though, he was able to get 5,000 new members through a contract with rose growers and mushroom growers in the Central Coast. So now they have about 26,000 members. There are about 50,000 people, though, that pick strawberries. So if you can get the strawberry workers to be unionized, the United Farm Workers will go three times its size, which will be really great for the UFW. So that's why the strawberries are the 11th highest producing crop in California. 80% of all the strawberries grown in the United States and consumed are grown in California, and half of those are grown right around Watsonville.
Wow.
So we're the largest concentration of strawberry growing in the nation. So So that's why we became the center of this. So that's where we are.
Yes. I think you are also the biggest shipper of berries, period, in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything I get in Dayton is from Watsonville. Mm-hmm. I don't eat frozen foods, so.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't have a thing against frozen foods.
Yeah, but,
I
but love, you prefer.
I love fruit and I love berries. And they're all from Watsonville until ours get ripe.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Thank you for yeah. that.
Yeah, that's another change too that went on. People's tastes went from frozen food, you know, during the shippers when we had the 20 packers and shippers in Watsonville down to 2. Part of that was because the shippers remained frozen in their frozen food stuff, while the tastes of American people changed and shifted to they wanting fresh produce.
Yeah, and see, you can get it almost any time, because you get it from Chile before you get it from Mexico, before you get it from Watsonville. You know, you can eat stuff all year long if you're willing to eat it from every place.
Yeah, yes.
Or pay for it from whatever.
Sometimes it can be expensive from the other places.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was that globalization going on at the same time too, where people that were eating in the United States didn't get their food just from their own state or region any longer, but got it from across the country, and then eventually from other countries too.
Did you say the Rodriguez that is now
the president.
There,
mm-hmm.
is he related to the original Rodriguez family?
No, he's not.
He's not?
No. It's just a coincidence. Okay. Yeah. But he is the son-in-law of Cesar Chavez.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I was part of the Great Boycott way back.
Uh-huh.
And shortly after I moved to Dayton, in fact, I was, I'm trying to think what group was behind that in Dayton, but anyway, that's something that I was...
Yeah, Catholic churches were very involved in the Great Boycott, as well as other Christian churches. It was really divisive issue in California with the Lutheran Church, because there would be some pastors that would be, and congregational members, they were really strong supporters of the union and were bringing resolutions to the district conventions and the assemblies. And it was shouting and booing and hissing, you know, as these things were being debated in the 70s. It was a really tough time for the Lutheran Church there. Do you remember some of that?
Yes, the boycott was certainly well known in our area too, and through the synod meetings and so forth. But we didn't sense the pull of the union with that. It was more, let's support the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the information we got.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was, that's an interesting thing. Is there a difference between the union and the workers? I think early on that the workers really made up the union, and they also very much admired Cesar Chavez. He was a great organizer. One of the things that he really did and was careful to do was develop relationships and heard the stories of the workers. Part of that he knew from his own experience, but he also helped, he trained his organizers to listen to the workers themselves and to help them listen to one another. So the union in the beginning had this, what I call a relational culture. They knew each other and they listened to each other.
Well. Am I not right that what he was trying to do was organize the workers? Originally, they were not organized.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
That was his mission, was mm-hmm. to organize them. And,
yes.
And the growers had, you know, thugs trying to discourage him, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Is that...
Yes. And part of the thugs were the Teamsters Union themselves. They came out into the fields with their clubs, beating up the UFW organizers,
mm-hmm.
or when they would try and during the strikes, during the strikes in the 70s and the boycotts in the 70s, the point of the strike was at those packing sheds. And that's where the Teamsters were inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Teamsters controlled the shipping end of things. And so when they set up their UFW strikes, the Teamsters folks came out and beat them up and busted up the line. So that happened a number of times. Yeah, so it was union folks fighting against union folks. you know, is that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in some ways. Now, though, under the AFL-CIO and the work that they've been doing to reform themselves and the Teamsters reform movement too, the Teamsters and the UFW have made a compact and an agreement so that in that 35,000 people, one of the largest contingents of marchers were Teamsters union members. That's made a big difference in what the UFW has been able to do. Can I sketch out what the modern day strawberry industry looks like in Watsonville? There are a number of layers that go on here. First of all, we've got the retailers. The Safeway stores, the Albertson stores, you know, all of your grocery stores that you go to. The retailers end up getting about 34 cents of every dollar that you spend for strawberries. They have some power in setting the price, but the real power in setting the market of strawberries sits here at the next layer with the shippers or coolers. Even though they only get about 15 cents of the dollar that you spend, they make a lot of profit on that. Because what they've done is, over the history of strawberry production in Watsonville, they have separated themselves from most of the labor costs and most of the land costs. Those will be borne by people down here. The only thing that they have to deal with for infrastructure is big refrigeration plants where they bring the strawberries in and do a quick cool so that then they can be transported out. The shippers and coolers, the other part of it, is that they control the plants that are planted in the fields. The shippers and the coolers have their own greenhouses and fields that grow the little tiny plants, and then they sell them to the actual farmers for a price. And they say, and they make a contract with those farmers. I say, any fruit that's produced off of this plant, you can only sell back to us. And then the shippers and coolers in that contract also say, we will pay you only up to this amount. So they put a ceiling on how much they're willing to pay the farmer. But there's no bottom level. They'll pay, you know, 5 cents for a basket of strawberries if the price gets that low. So they have removed their risk from the whole market, because they can buy as low as they want to, but they'll only pay a certain amount. And those farmers can only sell to the growers.
Will they only buy strawberries that are grown from their plants?
Yes.
Okay, so it goes both ways.
Is there anybody who isn't part of that? For example, I assume organic growers are not part of that, or am I wrong?
No, you're right. There are other smaller groups, like, but the organic strawberry farming is very small. And it's difficult because these shippers and coolers kind of have a corner on, I mean, they have genetic labs out there. They're really doing high advanced technological science in terms of strawberry production. What they've been able to do over time is to create strawberry plants that can last all the way from April to October producing strawberries. So they've lengthened the season of strawberry growing in Watsonville and in our area. And the plants, sometimes they'll last up to 2 years so that they can use them another time the next year. But a lot of times they just plow under. Another thing that's started to happen is a thing called methyl bromide in this period. Methyl bromide is one of the most deadliest pesticides that's used in the United States. It's supposed to be phased out, but the state of California and the federal government keep on giving it a 5-year extension. Mm-hmm. What methyl bromide does is that if you come to our area in the fall, you'll see all of these fields covered with plastic. I mean, hundreds of acres totally covered with plastic. Mm-hmm. Methyl bromide is a gas that they have to inject underneath that plastic, and it kills fungicides and nematodes. Those fungicides, fungus and nematodes, would kill the strawberry plants or would reduce their production. Without methyl bromide, the production of strawberries is cut in half. So it's really important to the growers. But it's so deadly that the State of California Environmental Protection Department couldn't even do any tests on it because the dogs would die before they could figure out how much to give them. So that's how deadly it is. It is also destroys the ozone. It's one of the major ways the ozone is destroyed. So that's why they have to have that plastic on top, so that the plastic supposedly keeps the methyl bromide in the ground, and it can decompose, the gas can decompose in the soil and under the plastic. So that's an environmental issue that's going on here. In terms of safety for you, yes?
Is it methyl bromide, is that poisonous when breathed or when eaten or all those? Or
it's a gas, so it's poisonous when breathed.
Oh yeah, okay.
And so it creates at least headaches and nausea and runny noses and eyes. And some of the schools and farms that are in the middle of the strawberry fields have suffered those effects. But they're supposed to be buffer zones and all that kind of stuff. It also, well, so that's, methyl bromide is part of the mix here. So that's the shippers and coolers. The next level are the growers themselves. And they can be landowners, some of them are landowners. And they grow the strawberries on their own land. But a lot of them are leaseholders. A lot of those old Croatian and Danish farmers and everything, well, they either got too old or their kids didn't want to be farmers themselves. So they continue to own the land, and they're doing something else now. But they lease it out to other farmers. The growers are made up of three sets. White, large farmers. Japanese middle-sized farmers. And Mexican Americans, who are the small farmers, the newest in the mix. The Japanese mid-size. Now there's a relationship between the white growers and their shippers and the Japanese growers and shippers. The Japanese formed two cooperatives that became shippers and coolers. So the Japanese and mid-size, they have a cooperative. A number of them belong to a cooperative. So they help set these prices up here. So they set the prices that they get for their own strawberries, but in a cooperative relationship. The white large growers have split themselves in two. They basically own two businesses. On one hand, they own their business of the fields and the producing of the strawberries. But corporately and separate, they have set up the shippers. So five of these large white growers own two of the shippers. But if they have a bad year growing in the fields, they can take that as a write-off and still make a lot of money in their shipping and cooling business. So they set themselves up corporately very smart because they can take the risk in the fields but still make money on the other hand.
But that can't be done by cooperatives, by the Japanese?
Not so much, but what they have to do is they set the prices for themselves then. And that there's a process that they go through which is a little bit more democratic. Five of these white large growers though, they take their own strawberries from their fields to their cooler, but they also take a lot of strawberries from the other folks too. So that's their money then, is on the other farmers.
Who sets the prices?
The shippers' coolers do. They set, you know, that ceiling, say we're not gonna set any more, we're not gonna pay you any more than this amount. And then it's a market kind of thing. If there's a lot of demand for strawberries out where you guys live, then the price is going to be higher. But the shippers will say, we're only going to pay this much. And they've set that ahead of time.
But if the shippers are in corporation with the growers don't have anything to say about the price that's set?
Well, not officially, but the people who sit on this board are
the same
five growers. Yeah, the same people.
So in a sense, it's not incest. It's certainly a cooperative kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. The growers get about 42 cents of every dollar that you get. But these are the folks who have to pay the labor costs and the land costs. So they have a large infrastructure cost in this section. Mexican Americans, the small growers, don't have a lot of access or power at the shipper cooler level of things. There's also one other shipper cooler that is unified in this direction. They own their corporation called Coastal Berry. They own their shipper, and they also run all of their growing operations. There's no separation there at all corporately. They have about 1,000 strawberry field pickers themselves, and they own the land, and then they lease other land too. So they do all of these things all together. A lot of the violations that the UFW was picking up were happening in these two areas. Violations were happening on Mexican-American-owned farms and on Japanese-owned farms. That means that race issues are much different, because it used to be that there was a subcontext that it was white growers who were oppressing Latino and Mexican-American field workers. It's not so much that anymore. It's Japanese and Mexican-Americans who have the most violations in their fields, because they're the smallest and they can't keep up to these high standards set by the Agricultural Labor Relations Act. Mm-hmm. It costs a lot of money to have that water in those porta-potties out there every day. The white folks, the large growers, can handle that cost, partly because they make their money in other places. And so they invite us to come out and smell their toilets. One of them says, "Come on, you can smell my toilets anytime. They're the cleanest in the county," and da 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 da. Well, they can do that because they've got the money to do it. These folks also pay the highest wages too. They have the highest per hour wages in the industry. It gets smaller and smaller as you go down to here.
Mike?
Yes?
Do you have any figures on like what percentage of berries comes from each of those three growers from the large?
No, I don't. I don't know how that breaks down. I think a lot they'll come from the larger ones. So the smaller from here. But these small farms only have maybe 10 to 40 field workers at a time employed by their grower. This, they might get up to 100, would be a large mid-size. These have 100 or more, 250 workers. So if you're a union and you want to do organizing, the easiest place to organize is where you've got a lot of strawberry workers all in the one place. It's much harder to get a contract with these small Mexican-American farmers, even though that's where the violations are. So what the UFW did is they highlighted the violations that were happening here in their fundraising campaigns. Said there's sexual harassment happening in the fields, which were happening in a couple of instances. There is no drinking water available. There's no health care benefits. These folks don't provide health care benefits to their workers. And so they highlighted some of those specific instances and then generalized them and said, this is what's happening in the whole strawberry industry. There might be sexual harassment happening here, though these folks have already got sexual harassment policies in place. These folks have never even thought about having a policy. So these things might be happening, but it's much harder to document here. So the UFW used the stuff that was happening here and tried to target them, the white large growers and the coolers. And they failed. They failed because for a couple of reasons. One reason is they did try and get a couple of contracts early on in the movement, and white growers, because they have their corporate setups differently, each farm is incorporated separately, even though they might own more than one. Where they got the contract, the union contract, they plowed under all the strawberries, and hundreds of workers were out of their jobs. So that put a lot of fear into the rest of the strawberry workers. If we go with the union, we're going to lose our jobs. The other thing that happened was that the organizing effort was not relational based like it was under Cesar Chavez. The organizing effort was, they had Union Summer, where they brought in a lot of Chicanos, politicized folks who grew up here in the United States and knew about the union movement in the 70s, and they were mostly young, from college age to in their 30s. Coming into Watsonville, most of the farm workers are all recent immigrants to the United States. And 50% of strawberry field workers are undocumented. Mm-hmm. So they go knocking on these doors and they say, "Hi, we're from the union. You want to be a part of the union?" "What union and why, you know?" "Well, the union of Cesar Chavez." "Oh, you mean the boxer?" Because in Mexico, one of the most famous people in Mexico is named Cesar Chavez, after the union organizer. But he's a boxer, and that's how Mexicans know him mostly. So they went in and they said, "You want to be a part of the union." They didn't do conversations to say, "Well, what's happening in your place? What are the issues for you?" They just heard about a couple of these, you know, terrible issues and then generalized them and then tried to do their organizing campaign. So they didn't form relationships. And the workers themselves said, "Wait a minute, I've got clean drinking water on my fields where I work. The majority of workers are probably over here. I've got clean drinking water. I don't really want health care benefits because I have to pay high rent and I want the cash up front. I don't want to, you know, gamble on whether or not I'm going to get sick someday. I need that cash up front." Stuff like that. So the issues that the union was trying to organize around weren't the issues of the workers themselves. So after 35,000 people marching through the streets of Watsonville, after 2.5 years of organizing efforts, and after millions of dollars spent by the AFL-CIO, they so far had one election, one place, one farm, where a majority of the workers said that they would want to have an election. That was at an organic strawberry field north of Santa Cruz. And it's so small, there's only, at the maximum, there's 20 workers there. And what I think, is that the organic farmer himself knew that his buyers wanted to have a union strawberry. And so I think he called the union and said, "Hey, come on up here." And so he gave them access to the fields, even gave a little speech about how if you join the union, it will help our marketing because the people who buy our strawberries want to know that you're part of the union. So even after support from the grower himself, they won the election. Only 17 people voted, and it was 9-8 in favor of the union. Only 9 people voted for the union. The union then had a great big celebration in San Francisco where Willie Brown, the mayor, hosted the big celebration and everything. But they had to do that. The union is having a really tough time. What they have done is they've tried to change their tactics. So they're now trying to do that relational organizing, listening to the workers, but it set them back. So I don't know if the union organizing effort is going to be successful in the long run in Watsonville. Yes?
I'd like to hear your idea of what would be the best things that might happen, and also, what are we from Colorado and Dayton and everything else supposed to do about what we've heard here today, in your view?
My perspective, personally, is that I am, even though I'm critical of some of the tactics of the union, I am in support of the union movement. I think the strawberry workers are going to be a lot better off if they get to be participants in setting what their wages are, what their health care benefits are. Right now, it's only the grower that gets to determine that, and the workers have to accept it. There's also no kind of guarantees that you'll be able to come back to your job the next year. So there's not a security that, okay, I've worked this season and then I can go back to my job the next season. If you, for some reason, anger your employer, one of your bosses along the way, then you won't come back. And then you'll be out of your job. So I think that the workers need to be unionized. I think that the union needs to continue to reform itself and strengthen itself. There's an issue about the union provides its own health care benefits called the Robert F. Kennedy Health Care Plan. And because their union membership has dropped so drastically, they've had to cut their health care benefits to their union members. And the union needs to do a better job of providing benefits for their members, I think, too. But that takes a lot of work. And in the new health care system that we've got, you know, it's really difficult.
Well, I know that that thing about the unions and would the workers be able to vote on whether union contributions could go someplace that you just voted on.
Mm-hmm.
That the unions themselves spent a lot of money and won that so that workers can't interfere with the decision of union leaders about how the money's spent. Is that about right? Something like that?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Unions, by law, are supposed to be democratic organizations. And then it's a question of how democratic are those unions. And some of them have not been very democratic. The Teamsters, like I was saying in this history, were not democratic at all for a long time. But now they're much more democratic. And but then you get to wonder about the bureaucracy. It's like in the Lutheran Church, we give our donations to the synod, and then at the synod budgeting, my congregation is one of 220 congregations making a vote on the budget. And we voted against the recent budget. So we're upset with how our money is being spent. But we have two options. We can not send our money to the synod, or we can reduce it, or we can keep on giving our money and try to change the system. But I think that's kind of an issue for the unions, and that the folks inside the union need to figure out how are they going to, if they disagree with an issue that their union leadership is taking, how are they going to get their leaders in there or make their negotiations? I don't think that the government should be telling unions how they should be spending their political dollars. I think the union members themselves should be doing that.
Right, I agree.
You want to talk?
I am very confused and feeling very ignorant about a subject that I thought I knew something about a while back. I was very supportive of Cesar Chavez when he was trying to get the workers together to overcome oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Now it sounds as if the union now is what he formulated the same union, or are they two different things? Because it sounds as if the union is really shafting them with their tactics. You said they plowed under their strawberries and all that sort of thing.
It was the growers who plowed under the strawberries. The union was trying to organize the workers, and when they got the workers organized, the grower then plowed under the strawberries.
Oh, I thought it was, you said the union did.
No,
okay,
no.
That's part of the confusion.
Yeah, good. Thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah. Now, Chavez's efforts in organizing the farm workers, did he then turn over that to the union, or is there a separate union, or is what he formulated what you're talking about?
It's still what he formulated. It's still the union that he started. But throughout Cesar Chavez's life, he developed and changed his tactics, as well as the rest of the union. So there was a point where even the Democrats didn't like the union, and because the Democrats were in cahoots with the Teamsters, you know. And so under Cesar Chavez, they made a shift from their organizational relational building and staying separate from the politics of California. So then they shifted to being definitely democratically aligned. And then they kind of lost some of their ability to stand outside of the political fray and keep on saying, this is what we need.
So the AFW is a part of
UFW.
What team? Part of what?
The UFW.
UFW. Is that a part of the Teamsters or another larger organization? Or
the UFW is now a member of the AFL-CIO, the National Labor Organization,
yeah,
which the Teamsters are also part of now. And the Teamsters and the UFW are now partners. They respect each other and they work together. They weren't working together in the 70s.
Yeah, that's my record of knowing what's going on. It's way back then.
Now, what do I suggest you can do wherever you live? I think one thing is to learn about the economy in your own area, because there's agricultural workers all across the United States. And what kind of situations are they in? California has some of the most stringent laws in favor of agricultural workers. In Florida and in Minnesota and elsewhere, they don't have such laws. So some agricultural workers don't even have to get paid the minimum wage, like they have to be paid in California.
Arizona is a totally non-union right-to-work state, so I have no idea.
So that's an issue. Another issue is to look and think about where you buy your food from. Like you were mentioning, you can buy it from Chile and from Mexico and stuff. Is that where you want to be buying your food from? What are the issues that are going on in labor issues down in those countries? In Mexico, they can use many more pesticides than they can use here in the United States. So it's much more dangerous to be a farm worker in Mexico than in the United States.
They also use human waste for fertilizer.
Yeah, they can do that as well. I would say that if union organizers come to your church and say, can we talk to you? Say yes, definitely. Find out what they're doing, ask them questions. And then as you go through your discernment process, maybe you'll want to be supportive of them. Yeah.
Our church is going to do, we've got a youth director who's really into all this stuff. Uh-huh. We're going to do a rural plunge this summer where we go out to the fields and talk to people. The teens and adults from our community are going to do that.
Good. And what's their focus? What are they going to talk about?
Well, they're just going to learn about all this, about farm workers and owners. And there's a Methodist church in Miami County, which is north of the county where Dayton is, that has been involved with farm workers for about 10 years. And so we're going to talk to people at that church, too.
That's good.
I'm looking forward to it.
Another thing that I would suggest, two more things and then we'll close. This relational organizing is really important. Not issue-based, not to form a relationship with farm workers just around grapes or something, but to form relationships with farm workers and with other people in your community that are based on getting to know one another. And then you can take action together on whatever issues are arising from your conversations. It's community organizing that I am really pushing each congregation to look at how you can be involved in a broad-based, diverse community organization project. Because that's how you're going to form relationships with folks that are not fleeting and are not just based upon one singular issue. And once that issue is over, like the grape boycott, and support for the union falls apart.
Saul Alinsky came to Dayton when I moved there.
Mm-hmm.
He was teaching community organizing there for a while.
So. Good. Saul Alinsky trained Cesar Chavez.
Right.
So Saul Alinsky was an organizer in Chicago and created a network called the Industrial Areas Foundation. And Cesar Chavez got his initial training from Saul Alinsky in that community organizing. And that's when the union was the most successful, was when they were following those practices. What our congregation is trying to do is to form a community-based organization based upon those principles again, which would include hopefully about 100 institutions, about 60 congregations, about 25 school associations, parent associations, some nonprofit groups, and five of the major unions in our area. One of them would be the UFW. So we hope that that's one way that the UFW can regain some of their relational stuff. That's the way that we're trying to have an impact on the union. Finally, keep on asking like our church did, who are the least of these? That's the question that Jesus asks us to ask. Who are the least of these? When all this was starting to happen in Watsonville, The union looked really powerful because it had their 35,000 people coming in and all the money from the national union movement. And the growers looked really powerful. So we had to consciously say, okay, who are the least of these and how are they being affected? By asking that question, it made the issues much more complex, but it also helped guide us in our actions, where we should be moving. And so that's my final word, is who are the least of these? Ask that and help that guide your feet. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Like I said, I'll be around all week, so if you have other questions about this. I have an article from the San Jose Mercury News that's really good. So if you wanted to have some information, it's got both sides of the issues on it, or all sides of the issues on it. So you can come up and get those.
If you're a strawberry worker, if you work for one of the farms, I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I grew up in North Dakota, great farm. So, I mean, do they go out and get strawberries every day for all those months?
Yeah. Depending on the weather, you know, as long as it's, you can go out and pick. So they work
there about. There are plants that are producing all of that time.
All that time. And they, it's like this.
This is where they used to have.